Here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discuss during the Super Terrific Happy Hour should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, to say nothing of super and terrific, of course, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show.
People always tell me, you should have your money working for you. Because you send your money out there working for you, a lot of times it gets fired. You go back there, what happened? I had my money, it was here, it was working for me. Yeah, I remember your money. We had to let him go.
Welcome everybody to another edition of the Super Terrific Happy Hour. Joining me, as always, because nothing would be super terrific or happy without her, is the indefatigable Stephanie Pomboy.
Oh my gosh. I have to come up with a better response to that. It's super terrific, and I'm very happy to be with you.
Fantastic. Now, you are back in Florida, I take it.
I am. That's sweltering.
I hate to throw background. That.
And you are in Zurich? Where are you?
Yes, I am. I am in Zurich, which is cold and wet and grey and dark, really, which is a little unfortunate, but hey, that's just the way it goes, I guess. Sometimes at this time, yeah, I think you expect it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I look forward to the day when we're actually at least in the same time zone doing one of these, but here we are.
Right? Wouldn't that be nice? Let alone the same place. Maybe we could do one in person at some point. What do you think?
Oh my gosh, that would just be beyond.
Well, listen, I am delighted to say we have a guest returning to the podcast to join us. Now, you and I were noodling before we started recording this as to when it was that we had this conversation. When do you think it was? Because I think you
have the answer now?
I do. I have the answer now. I've been trying to find it. I have the answer. When do you think it was?
I think it was probably before the Fed even started raising interest rates. So maybe...
Give me a month and a year.
I'll say December 2022. No, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah. No, December 2021.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Boy.
You are so far off. It's not even funny. I would have said summer 21.
Okay.
It was July 2020.
No.
I kid you not.
Okay. Wow.
That is extraordinary.
That's crazy.
Yeah, right? That is absolutely extraordinary.
Well, the only thing more stunning than that is that this particular guest wanted to come back.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, listen, maybe he doesn't want to come back. Maybe it's been so long he's forgotten he ever did the podcast in the first place. That is a possibility. That is a possibility. And when he joins us, if you don't tell him, I won't, that he's been on before. Maybe we should just welcome him. This is the first time.
This is a moment of weakness, I guess,
if we trigger his PTSD. Anyway, so they go, hang on a second. I'm getting a horrendous bit of deja vu here.
Right, exactly.
Well, listen, I tell you what. Why don't you tell people who our returning guest is? Give them a little bio.
Drum roll, please. We have none other than the, and I will use your adjective of the day, indefatigable, Cy Jacobs. Cy, for those who are regular listeners to the Super Terrific Happy Hour, runs a hedge fund under the name Jacobs Asset Management, coincidentally, that does long-short U.S. financials, or actually, I guess we'll say North American financials, or maybe it's global financials, but I think it's mostly predominantly U.S. And I've known Cy for 100 years, and we sort of held hands and commiserated going into the global financial crisis and all of the financial mayhem around that. So it's always exciting in times like this to get his take on what's going on in the financial world, and looking forward to getting all that color today.
Your timing is perfect because he has just joined us.
Look at that. Hello, the man himself.
Welcome back to the podcast. Thank you so much for doing this. I'm glad we finally got to a time when the three of us could get together. I guess the easiest thing
The tape is on, right, Grant?
Yes, the tape is on. I will not forget to ever do that again. I promise you that much. One time is enough. So obviously, financials have been, or were certainly for everybody last year, ground zero. Since then, it's kind of quietened down for most people. Can you just give us a sense
of whether it really has quietened down, because I suspect it hasn't, but you wouldn't know that from kind of reading the headlines and the mainstream commentary.
Well, it depends what you are referring to that things are quieting down from, because there's so many cross currents. I mean, you know, you can go back to COVID, you can go back to the bank failure run, you know, only 6 months ago. But, you know, look, my view of things is that things appear to be quieting down, partially because the markets have adopted this, you know, consensus view that we're going to have a soft landing and that credit is deteriorating. But that's okay, because it's the new catchphrase. You know, this cycle's ring fenced is normalization. You know, it's credit's deteriorating, but it's normal. It's going to be a soft landing, and you can actually kind of ignore the credit deterioration, because it's just we haven't even reverted to the mean yet. It's going to be fine, normal. And, you know, my view is that where we're coming from is extraordinary. So, you know, we should have had a credit cycle at the end of last decade, and then we had this bizarre shock to the system of COVID, which at first looked like a disaster, but actually turned, and in many human ways it was, but for markets, it turned into a booster shot, pardon the pun, like a liquidity booster shot. And the party just got much better before there was even a chance to have a normalization from what was fantastic credit in, ever since the GFC. So I think that's the market mentality now. You know, my view of what's going on in financials and the economy is that the economy is slowing from its post-COVID highs, and it's slowing, you know, very unevenly from this sort of torrid pace. And when we talked 3 years ago, I think the consensus amongst us cynics was that, you know, rates, you know, couldn't go up much. You know, I think we talked about how there's sort of like a cap on what rates can go up because the economy and markets can't. I think we were talking about sort of 3%, and we would refer to yield control to avoid that from happening. And, you know, I guess we got that wrong. It was lower for longer, for sure. And, you know, now it's shifted to higher for longer in the span of these 3 years. And, you know, one of the things that Jay Powell keeps repeating, but I think, you know, people ignore, is, you know, his always mentioning that higher rates have a lagged and variable effect. And I think we're in the lagged phase, and we're going to find out how not pretty the variable is when the lag goes on for longer. But I think, you know, we are living off of the incredibly powerful stimulus, and it's shifting there. You know, you have to remember that there are lags in the effective rates. Credit is itself a lagged indicator, so it just doesn't look that bad. But, you know, I see coincident indicators these days that I think bode for trouble. I think that there's been, you know, stubbornly low, you know, I say that sort of ironically, stubbornly low unemployment, you know, because of, you know, the great resignation, because of, you know, employer hesitation to let workers go because they were so hard to find. So recently, you know, there's still lots of good solid vengeance spending going on, even as, you know, liquidity and stimulus dries up. But I see, you know, one of the like coincident indicators, just episodic, I would point to. I listened to an earnings call last week for the company ZipRecruiters.com, sort of online employment, new age, new tech oriented employment agency. And if you listen to the management introduction, you'd think we're in a recession. They were whining and complaining about how, I mean, they flat out said the great resignation is over. Supply of labor is coming back. And they basically said, you know, in Seinfeldian terms, that now employers have hand. And it's been a long time since employers have had hand. And, you know, they're cutting edge. This is like the tech economy. This is supposed to be the strongest part of the economy. So I thought that was noteworthy. Used car prices, which, you know, are volatile, very economically sensitive, and were highly abnormal in the aftermath of COVID. I mean, it's a depreciating asset. There is no more certainly depreciating asset than a car. And it appreciated, you know, even, you know, the way they take time out of the equation, it appreciated that way, and it appreciated, period. Used car prices were going up for 2 years, which is, you know, historically bizarre. And, you know, they've resumed declining. I think they've resumed declining, absolutely. I think they've resumed declining, you know, relative to a static age of a specific car model. And I think that that's going to continue. And it's interesting, last month was really bad. I think they were down a couple few percent month to month, and they should have gone up because of the auto strike. So I think supply is coming back, demand is receding, affordability of used cars is finally hurting and biting. Inventories are piling up despite the strike, and now the strike's over. And that's leading to worsening subprime lending delinquencies. So that's like the variable uneven part of it. You know, the parts of the economy still booming, but I see cresting. And, you know, what I don't expect is that it'll be sort of smooth. And, you know, I don't expect the extraordinary upcycle to be followed by a normalization. And yet, still, it's a long way to normal. So I just think that even the move to normalization of credit isn't going to be fun. The move past it is going to be really painful. And I would say the equity markets are just not expecting it. So the other thing I'm thinking about these days is, we talked about it 3 years ago a little bit. I think, you know, I think I probably like had just heard of Wall Street Bets at the time we did that podcast. And I think we were kind of like snickering about it, you know, how cute and silly. And look, because of lower for longer, because of so much cheap money, that became a really, really powerful thing. And the amateurs kind of routed the professionals there for a while. I mean, it ended up being sort of horrible for everybody as these things go. But for a while, you know, they kind of targeted short sellers. And in this period of time where that was sort of kind of amateur, kind of brilliant in a way, you know, as now portrayed in the movie Dumb Money, which I just couldn't bring myself to see. I looked at the trailer and saw Seth Rogen playing Gabe Plotkin, and I said, I'll like have a coronary if I watch this movie. So, but that was not only a thing for a while, but in a lot of ways it's become institutionalized because, you know, now you have big money center banks and brokerage firms having created baskets that they will write derivatives on all day long of indexes of heavily shorted stocks. It's just like a factor that people play, and there's no research into the stocks you're buying or valuation or fundamentals. I think it's the time, the day, the hour, the week, the month to be long heavily shorted stocks. So, you know, they've really come after the short sellers in this era of loose money and really thinned out the ranks. I mean, there's not that many of us left. It's just been a culling of the herd, as they say. But then, you know, beyond, you know, we'll get back to this sort of short selling era and where it creates opportunities. But, you know, specifically in sort of my world of financials, you know, I think it's made investors sloppy. You know, it made, you know, some banks really sloppy. Obvious best examples, you know, Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic. I mean, at the time we did our last podcast and right until, you know, maybe a month or two before they were seized and failed, they were not seen as cowboys, those two banks. They were like held out as shining success stories. The constantly repeated view of those two names is that they manage credit risk so well. You know, they're not credit risk takers. And that was true. And that isn't what got them. But, you know, they got punched drunk on cheap, loose, endless deposits, seemingly endless deposits. And, you know, they took the bait of the regulators, you know, basically incenting banks after the great financial crisis to not take credit risk. But what should they do? They should invest in the risk-free asset. T-bills and mortgage-backed securities. They almost mandated it. I mean, they really suppressed the credit risk and more or less mandated through risk-weighted capital rules that they do it. So some banks and depositories ended up falling prey very quickly. You know, we're talking about the tide just starting to turn. They're gone already. And, you know, we thought that was, you know, like the beginning of the end. But I think it was only the beginning of the end, turns out. And then, you know, elsewhere in my world, fintech, you know, really became a huge beneficiary of cheap credit and capital flows to venture capital. And, you know, the extension, you know, like I said, there should have been a credit cycle at the end of the last decade. Instead, there ended up being like a supercharged liquidity cycle starting when the credit cycle should have been starting. And so it just got, you know, more dramatic. And it kind of allowed, like in my world, to perpetuate, you know, on steroids, the myth that technology can replace underwriting. And because technology has replaced, you know, human underwriting, you can grow it really fast because we have these sort of like perfect models. And the investors wanted to see growth. So they gave them growth. And we talked about this last podcast. You see this every 5 to 10 years, you know, at least since I've been paying attention in the 80s. Technology is always replacing human underwriting and causing higher growth and then wrecks in the down cycle. And it just happened more dramatically this time, but where we haven't seen the full downside yet. One of the things I wrote down, because I knew I was going to bring this up, and one of the companies that we've been short in the fintech space, a company called Affirm, they're buy now, pay later, that, you know, like, which is just, you know, this cycle's newfangled fintech technology replacing credit extension, but not really. They have this thing, they talk about it in their conference calls, they actually put it on their website, where they, paraphrasing, that Affirm does not treat delinquencies or defaults as an outcome. We choose acceptable delinquency rates as an input. So they're basically saying, we decide in advance what our losses are going to be. And then what happens later to our customers, to their jobs, to their employers, to their companies, to their, you know, to everything else doesn't matter. We have these models, and, you know, we're going to gear it to the model, and it knows all, and it allows us to grow at rates that justify our cost of capital.
So did that model assume that this would be like a repeat of the subprime mortgages where people missed their very first payment? Because that's happened in a huge amount of cases, hasn't it?
Well, we'll find out. It's, you know, with unemployment still in the threes, you know, we haven't found out how great the models are yet, I believe.
I think we probably know, though.
Right.
I think so. You know,
yeah, like I do think we know. It just hasn't been proven yet.
And then back to my current, like, you know, maybe market view, market structure view, which I think is important, is, you know, we talked about the short selling business. I see it, and I have lots of friends who see it, and it's just kind of obvious. There's like this thing that I call short seller PTSD. You know, it's been really bad, and it makes you rethink, you know, whether fundamentals really matter. And, you know, one of the sort of short baiting and squeezing effects is, even when you're right and you have a good year and you're right about the stock and actually the wind turns your way, let's say in 2022, the market structure these days is such that you have these just unbelievably vicious short squeezes, you know, within, or, you know, bear market rallies within decline. So, you know, I'll give you a couple examples near and dear to my nearly broken heart by this. You know, we mentioned SIVB. So I was short SIVB. I watched it go up, didn't take the bait, and then went from somewhere in the hundreds, in the low hundreds, like in March of 2020. I think it got to 800 or 700 something in late 21. And then it started falling and falling and falling. And then I finally got involved on the way down. And, maybe like in the summer, fall of 2022. So maybe it was like 400 by then. So like I missed half the move down. And I got involved finally because, look, rates had gone up enough. The math just wasn't working anymore. And deposits were outflowing because of, rates had gone up. Venture capital cycle had turned down. They seemed doomed. But the stock was still 400 and beloved. And it was playing out. I mean, to some extent, I kind of played it the coward's way and waited. But, it was certainly finished. So I thought, and stock worked and, in the third and fourth quarter went down, got into the hundreds, and then they kind of pulled the classic, rates stopped going down a little bit, like in the fourth quarter. And then they got, I think it was like the Goldman Sachs conference in early December 2022. And they got up at the Goldman Sachs conference and said, we're changing guidance. We've been talking to our customers. We think they're slowing cash burn, and the venture capital cycle is going to turn mid-year 2023, and deposits are going to start flowing in again. We're living through the worst, and now it's going to get better. And the stock went up 75% in the next 45 days, and then they failed. And then it went down 100%, in the next 30 days. That 45-day rally, 75%, for somebody who thought it could be a zero, was brutal. And that's just a regular day in the office for a short seller. So that's how it is.
You don't have a single gray hair, as far as I can tell. So it's amazing.
Yeah. Look closer, Steph. And then another example, kind of like, we're talking about a firm. One of my favorite shorts the last couple of years have been this company, Upstart, the AI subprime personal lender that, raised money on its AI-osity, how wonderfully AI it was, and went public right at the right time, like December 2020 at $20 a share. Stock went to 400. I sat on the sidelines for the next year. Same thing as Silicon Valley. I, took the sort of coward's way, waited until it was down and rates were rising and things were really starting to turn against them. I thought liquidity was going to dry up for them. Shorted it on the way down to 100, at 100. So that was like early 2022. And then the stock, as they say in Spinal Tap, went to 11, literally, right. Down to 11. And, from over 100, from 400, just a year and a half earlier. And, it was a victory. I flashed the mission accomplished flag and become a small position because it had gone down. I kind of defended my position the way down, but it had just become small. And then between May of this year and, August of this year, it went from 11 to 75 or so. It went up 6.5, 7-fold on NVIDIA beating earnings and sort of AI becoming a thing and Upstart being included in AI baskets and heavily shorted baskets and heavily shorted AI baskets. And nothing was really improving there. And now the stock's back to 20. But, I'm not sure it was worth it.
Can I actually ask you that? Because I find this fascinating. And I've watched Upstart with just this bewildered look on my face. Talk a little bit about how you manage that, right? Both of those are perfect examples of how a good short seller, A, waits for the thing to start really falling. B, looks for the catalyst, like rates rising at the same time, and is happy to wait from 400 to 100 before they make the move to get, you call it the coward's way out, tongue in cheek, That's how short sellers survive, by waiting for that part, right? But talk about...
Oh, Grant, I'm giving you the good examples. Like, I don't know...
No. I'm sure. But mentally, the Upstart is such a great example. How do you manage that? Because you know there's no there, and yet you still have to manage that. You know it's probably going back again, ultimately. But how do you manage the mental side of that? And how do you decide when and how to... that you're forced to adjust your position somehow, even though you know it's just madness. You have to do it for risk management purposes.
I mean, look, we don't have regimented, I don't work at one of these big shops with risk managers roaming the desks and then all that. I'm like founder, portfolio manager, and risk manager. So, I don't have these hard and fast rules that, I get closed out of positions, without even realizing it. Which is good and bad. So it's just more risk on my shoulders and nobody else's shoulders. And what can I say? It's like the agony of defeat and, whatever that was on sports, on the wide world of sports.
The joy of victory and the agony of defeat. Yeah.
You get it every day or every other day. And look, even in these, I cherry picked these two stories because they sort of ended up okay. But on those rise, the 75% rise in SIVB in 45 days, the six-fold increase in Upstart after with down 95% this year. Look, in both cases, I covered some on the way up. I had to, I have some position size limits. You have a terrible month and quarter. I like to think of myself as a really long-term investor, but my clients don't necessarily see things the same way, and I report monthly. It's a human business. And so, you have to, sometimes you can ride it out and sometimes you can't. And, sometimes you have to get out of the way and re-engaged. In both these cases, I ended up getting it right. But the thrill of victory was diminished by the fact that I wasn't short as many shares, as many dollars or shares really, when it went down. And then on the way down, you just had to constantly, re-underwrite. And you can't play it perfectly. So I played it imperfectly and it turned out okay, at the loss of sleep and stomach lining. And that's the world we live in, on the short side. And I think, what can I say? I think we're in a kind of deflating bubble, reversion to the mean, reversion past the mean, whatever you want to call it. I think, the short side is going to work. It's been really thinned out. I think there's opportunities for good, really good stock picking on that side. But, look, every day is a new day. So, here we are in November 2023. And what's my mindset now? I gave you sort of my macro mindset, but I'm not a macro investor. I'm a long, short, market neutral stock picking investor. So I have to kind of work both sides of my brain. And, one of the things I'm thinking about these days, because half my positions, I'm meant to be a market neutral equity fund. So, more or less half my positions, should be shorts. And I'm kind of cynical, and just about everything I've said so far in this talk is contrarian and bah humbug. And half my positions are long. So, how do I think about that these days? I've been thinking a lot about, the word popped into my head a couple of weeks ago, the title of Nassim Taleb's book, Anti-Fragile, which I read when it came out 10 years ago or 11 years ago. And it popped back into my head and I went back and reread parts of it and skimmed it. And, look, it's a great physiological, almost human body and psychological term. He was trying to relate it to the investment world. So, the title of the book is Anti-Fragile, The Things That Gain from Disorder. So basically, his point is that like anti-fragile is like a step beyond resilience. So it's not just resilient, you benefit from disorder and disorderly stressors, as he calls it, and talks about in the investing world, one of the obvious ways to play it is vol. What's more anti-fragile than being long vol? But I'm not a vol trader. In fixed income, it can be as mundane as like barbell strategy in fixed income. You own T-bills, and the 30 year and nothing in between. And, you know, it's stability and some sizzle. And, you know, of course, he gives this like sociological example of, this is before the Me Too movement. He says, a woman should marry an accountant for stability, but, you know, have flings with rock stars. So you kind of get both. It's like a good hedge, and it's like 1 + 1 = 3.
I'm writing this down here.
So, the way I'm thinking about it is, you know, what are the things, you know, if I've got to be long things, you know, what are the things in my worldview that might benefit other than short selling? So I already have the short selling side of it, but if I, you know, I have to like at least fake being bullish on some things. And I feel like I'm having a good time of coming up with anti-fragile longs, which might be counterintuitive, but, you know, the kind of things I'm thinking about there are a little bit, you know, indulge me, a little bit outside my area of supposed expertise in financials, but I'm sort of fascinated in the natural resource space by the opportunity that ESG investing and sort of the green movement and, you know, all of that has created. So what intrigues me is that there's been, you know, in support of all of the goal to create clean and green energy, you know, wind and solar and all that, there's also been a structural, because what the investment community has done, structural underinvestment in natural resources, some of which ironically are going to see increased demand because EV batteries, you know, wind turbines, like solar panels, are all made out of stuff. They're all made out of things that you need to, you know, rape and pillage the earth to, you know, to come up with. And nobody has wanted to, you know, invest in that the last 10 years. So, you know, you could see easily a situation where like the green alternative energy push, which I support and think will continue, is going to create shortages of silver, which is you need lots of to make a wind turbine, you need lots of to create a solar panel, and the list goes on and on and on of what you need more of and what has been underinvested in. Another great example of that, which you touched on, I think, on in the last super terrific happy hour with your guests, is the opportunity in nuclear, which completely fits in with what I just said. I think we are, it's beyond a prediction, we are in a huge swing from seeing nuclear as horrible to seeing nuclear as a savior, as a clean energy to replace dirty energy with. And because like the transition's not working out so well, I think it's going to get speeded up as much as it can be sped up. Yet the thing you need for nuclear, uranium, has been in this horrible bear market for 12 years until this year, really. No capital spending, no exploration. Mines have been shut. They take a really long time to reopen. And, you know, so that's, you know, another sort of natural resource that, you know, the things going on in the world are going to support the price of, and they've been underinvested. So, you know, while we've been, you know, surrounded by malinvestment in treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities and venture capital and commercial real estate, critical minerals and metals have been underinvested in. So you might say, why are you talking about this here, bank and financials manager? What's the play here? And I think the play is, I mean, there are a couple of publicly traded plays, but the way to think about it, to extend, you know, my kind of bullishness on precious metals, because I just believe that paper money printing and debasement leads to firmer precious metals. And we've been through such a dramatic period of money printing and debt monetization, you know, that is coming. And I think that what's fascinating now is that the world is buying precious metals again. Central banks are buying precious metals. The world was always more interested in precious metals than the United States was. We Americans are like a trusting lot. You know, we've had it good for all these, you know, for the last few centuries, and to trust our government more, and haven't had wars fought on our soil and all that. So, you know, on the scale of which countries buy and store precious metals, the United States is way, way, way down there. And now central banks are starting to hoard gold. For obvious reasons that you guys talk about on your podcast all the time. I won't go into it. You know, the way Americans typically do it is through GLD, you know, and that's been out of favor, but it's still like the largest, most prolific way to own gold. But GLD is just like this sort of pile of derivatives, basically. It's not, you can't cross the border you know, with your GLD certificates. You can't escape. So I think there's a trend here, and the way to play it in financial stocks is the trend towards physical investing, physical precious metals, and with the appendage of physical precious metals and uranium investing. I think it's turning. You know, we've seen signs of it the last several years. So the last election, which was kind of contested, the capital riots afterwards, you know, COVID and worrying about the like ATMs not working, some challenges to law and order here in the United States, bank runs earlier this year, you know, they're all kind of conducive to like this thought, ooh, maybe I should own some physical gold and silver and have it in non-derivative form, like on me or in my bunker. And, you know, there is a large subculture of America, gold and silver hoarding, gun hoarding, canned goods hoarding, but I think it's just becoming a little more mainstream. Like directionally, it's just becoming more normal. And we saw these episodes in some of these things, political sort of social tension things I mentioned. There were these things called silver squeezes. They're like shortages of physical, not on the commodities exchanges, but it was hard to come by coins and bars of silver for stretches of time the last couple of years, and premiums to spot went up. And I think more is ahead. You know, just survey the world, you know, what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on in this three-way kind of superpower stare down, you know, with the United States, Russia, and China, the falling faith in paper money, you know, inexorable thing that we all talk about. The 24 election, I mean, this is just like setting up to be a really polarized, contested, tight election. I just think it's all, there's so much that can go wrong. You know, like the bull case for physical metals is just Murphy's Law of, you know, what can go wrong in the world.
I have news for you though, Cy. If you think you got PTSD being in the short side of the U.S. stock market and financials, wait until you get a taste of PTSD being long precious metals for a while. You have no facial tics yet, but...
it's just been boring. Not brutal. Brutally boring, maybe, but it hasn't been money losing. It's been money making over time. So instead of owning, you know, physical, which I do personally, but in, you know, in my business, the way I can play it, there's two publicly traded ways to play it. So one of it is a company called A-Mark Precious Metals. They are basically started out as like a wholesale, they're a broker dealer, precious metals broker dealer. So they used to and still do supply coin and metal, gold and silver buying shops. You know, they're like where all those players get supply, offload risk to, borrow money from. And now they've vertically integrated. They started buying, they bought two mints. So they went sort of downstream. So they actually own where the stuff is created. And they've also bought a series of, you know, online digital gold and silver coin and bar retailers, most famously JM Bullion, which I think is the largest one in the United States. And they're very profitable, very well run. They allocate capital very well. And, you know, given what you've seen, you know, especially on the right-leaning half of America in sort of civil unrest and bank runs and contested politics in the last few years, you know, I can think of no better long play than owning the broker dealer that would benefit from increased volumes and spreads going into 2024 and everything that's going on. The other way to play it, and this is where uranium comes in as well, is the company Sprott. They used to be like a brokerage firm that underwrote gold and silver miners and explorers and all that. And they've really moved away from that and actually spun off that business. And they've become a much more mundane and highly cash flow generating money manager. Their shtick is physical. You know, so their largest fund is, you know, it's known as FIS, P-H-Y-S. It's simply, you know, every dollar, every share of FIS owns the equivalent amount of gold bar sitting in Sprott's vault in Canada. It's just a one-to-one relationship. That's all it is. No derivatives, just gold bars. And, you know, so it's almost like a streaming and royalty company. They don't decide what the portfolio composition is. They don't need analysts or portfolio managers. It's just a vault. And, you know, they get 75 basis points or whatever it is. And, you know, they have that for silver. And now famously, so they've got about upwards of $20 billion of that stuff, precious metals, physical trusts, low cost, you know, 85% margins on the margin as AUM grow, like 85% of it falls to the bottom line. And then the new development there is that when uranium was in the tail end of its vicious bear market, they happened to buy for almost nothing the largest, though it was small, uranium physical trust. This was a couple few years ago. It had several hundred million dollars in it. And the timing was just incredible. And they, you know, uranium's become of interest, has grown. It's like a Roach Motel. You can buy it and they'll sell you shares at a, you know, at the market offering when it's trading at NAV or above, and they'll take the money and they'll buy drums of uranium with it. But you can't take delivery of your uranium. It never comes out. They're just taking it off the market. So it's gone from 500 million, whatever it was when they bought it, to now, I believe it's $5 billion of drums of uranium, you know, sitting in various uranium storage facilities around the world. And it has sucked up the excess supply of uranium, just as demand from utilities is coming back. So, you know, and then they also have a uranium equities fund that, you know, has all the leverage to, you know, rising uranium prices because they own the largest miners and the smallest miners and all that. And it's, you know, I think it's a great business. It trades, you know, earnings have gone nowhere for a lot of years. So it trades like an out of favor money manager relative to other, and this is the parent company, Sprott. You know, there's all these sub funds, you know, the physical trusts and all that also trade public. But I own the parent company. It's like the casino, owning the casino. And, you know, it trades at like 10, 11 times cash flow. And publicly traded money managers trade at, you know, when they're growing and in favor, you know, like T. Rowe a couple of years ago, or Cohen and Steers as a specialty manager when, you know, real estate investing was all the rage, trade at 20 to 30 times cash flow when they're growing and, you know, in favor. And I think we're at the inflection point with Sprott. And again, it's not that bold a prediction. You know, uranium is now up to, in total, over $6 billion of AUM from nothing a few years ago. And, you know, God forbid precious metals break out and the other 75% of their business, you know, start growing too, with the economies of scale and 85% marginal cash flow margins. It would be a favorite.
So can we dig in a little deeper on where you think we are now in this credit cycle? You talked earlier about the subprime auto delinquencies and general commentary about the used car market and how that impacted that. But do you think that the increase in delinquencies we're seeing now and the pace with which they're rising suggests that we're going to see a quick deterioration rapidly past normal into the overshoot on the other side? Or do you see this as sort of just a gradual slow motion train wreck that's building momentum now?
Yeah, like I would say the latter. It's hard to know, and I don't have that strong opinion. I mean, I think it's slow motion train wreck from great to normal. And, you know, I would guess past it. And the trains, you know, left the station, you know, clearly. So the short side of my book, it's almost less interesting and there's less to talk about it. I think that, you know, where we are is that the stocks have come off their highs a lot in the past year, especially last year and earlier this year. To some extent, they're like statistically cheap. I mean, if you look at the banks are statistically cheap. You know, if they earn their guidance and what analysts say they're going to earn in 2024, they're going to be good stocks because bankers don't guide for deteriorating credit. You know, they only acknowledge it when it's happened. So everyone's guiding to normalization, and it's going to be controlled and contained and not bad. And I think that the stocks, they just reflect that. I should say they reflect worse than that. I think the valuations reflect worse than guidance, worse than estimates. So they reflect things getting back to normal. And, you know, the hardest part is knowing which ones are going to go past and which ones aren't. And to some extent in banks, like we're market neutral banks now. We're, you know, we're long a bunch of things we like. We think that, you know, have sort of a history and a marketplace and a management team to stay out of trouble. And we're long things that are in hotter markets where we think there have been excesses. You know, if I could boil it down to one example, I'd say short credit in Austin, Texas, and long credit in Syracuse, New York, or, you know, upstate New York. And I think it'll be a good stock picker's market in that regard. And look, same thing for specialty financial services. You know, we've been short CarMax and Ally. You know, the stocks are way off their highs. Credit has started to deteriorate. The market's not entirely whistling past the graveyard on those. The stocks have worked. You know, it's just like a call now as to whether it's going to get worse or not. I bet on worse, but I'm not being alarmist here. We're picking and choosing on the short side. We, you know, we're short commercial real estate rate and volume sensitivity. So, you know, we're short a couple of players that are commercial mortgage bankers or brokers effectively. So they really care about velocity. I think velocity is going to be really slow. You know, a lot of the people who clip the coupons, get fees for originating, selling, securitizing, they have this tail credit risk, which has been off the table for 15 years, 14 years. Like no one thinks about it. Nobody has it in their models. It never comes back to bite you. You know, I'll take the over on that. I think that, you know, there's some hidden credit risk that this generation is just not used to analyzing and putting in their earnings model. So
just like they weren't used to analyzing the prospect of home prices going negative nationally back during the global financial crisis. But to your point, Si, I read an article today, and I forget where it was, that talked about the long versus short exposure to financials and basically said, I forget, maybe it was Goldman, it was some prime broker that said its clients, it was the lowest since they started tracking it. The long exposure was the lowest relative to short. So that kind of speaks to your point that they
Yeah, the
already-
stocks reflect, the stocks reflect less optimism than the guidance and the estimates. So yeah, I think that's right. I mean, like you know, as part of market structure these days, everybody, we all used to spend our time talking to companies and going to conferences and analyzing spreadsheets and models and all that. Now everybody spends all the time trying to figure out what everybody else is doing. That's the market structure. And the most valuable research that, you know, these brokerage firms puts out are like these surveys of what's overowned and what's underowned. And what are the favorite names? What are the hated names, you know, by hedge funds? And, you know, you're supposed to do the opposite of that. And, you know, you can just wrap yourself into a pretzel trying to figure out what everybody's doing and how that should drive what you're doing. And I, you know, I try not to do that.
But so that it's funny you mentioned CarMax and Allied, and this is the perfect example to me, because by far the crappiest company in that whole ecosystem is Carvana, right?
Yeah.
By far. But if you try and play that, you could have got it right and made an awful lot of money, and you could have been absolutely crucified by getting it wrong, by picking the worst company in the sector.
Yep.
And getting carried out. It just shows you how difficult that whole thing is.
Yeah. So I, you know, I don't know whether I'm ashamed or proud of the fact that I lost money short in Carvana, but that's, you know, I didn't use Carvana as an example earlier on, because it ended well for me intellectually, but badly financially. So, right. You know, I was shorted too early. So that, we talked about this earlier. Yeah, that's right. One that I didn't get. I shorted too early, covered, never went back. And I actually, in my letter to investors last year, I said one of my regrets of 2022 is that I had no position in Carvana when it went down. Saw it coming, lost money on it, didn't come back. So yeah, that ties together, ties the earlier part of the conversation too well.
right. But that, you know, I've followed that stock because to me, it's so emblematic of everything that's wrong with this, because the company is basically a bust, and it basically went bust, right? It went all the way down, I think got to 3, and today it's back at 30. It shouldn't still exist, and it got squeezed, and all the stuff that you obviously know better than I do, having had a position in it, it's just a poster child for me of A, everything that's wrong with this part of the cycle, and B, the fact that there is still so much that has to be unwound. It's terrifying.
Yeah. Well, I'm nervously smiling because I didn't even know the stock was at 30. Like I'm blissfully unaware. Like I put it on the do not touch list. And I should have taken it off, but I didn't. And that's okay.
But to that point about how much is left to go, what I was trying to get at earlier, Sai, on asking where we are in the cycle and how bad you think it could get, is the unprecedented speed and magnitude with which rates increased. And, you know, we talked or you discussed the Fed continuing to pound the table about these lags. And obviously, it's more than a year and a half since they first started raising rates. We're reaching the point where those lags should be lapsing. And the question that I wrestle with is, it's hard for me to imagine that we'll feel the first 25 basis points and then the next 50 and then the next 50. It seems like it more likely to hit us, you know, running into a brick wall all of a sudden. But I'd be interested in whether you think it's relevant, the speed and magnitude that the Fed raised rates, or if this cycle will pretty much play out on the credit side the way prior cycles have.
Yeah, look, I think we talked about lagged and variable response. Like it's completely uneven. There's no answer to that question. I don't believe. Look, I think you spend more time thinking about this than I do. I just see the outcomes and react to them in individual stocks and financials. But, you know, like our commercial real estate short is built around the fact that there's like a hidden lag in the effect of higher interest rates. It's not immediate. There may be like an immediate effect on volume, on how much more building and expansion there is, because it becomes more expensive to borrow and develop. And I think we've started to see that. And there's an immediate effect on no refinancings, both residential and commercial. Refi was a big thing, big equity withdrawal mechanism for commercial, not only residential. So that has ground to a halt. The delayed effect is the fact that most commercial mortgages are fixed to floating or fixed, you know, with low amortization. And then, you know, after 5 years or 7 years or 10 years, you have to either go amortizing or, you know, your coupon goes way up. And like we're in that in between. There's a lot of commercial real estate owners that are saying, oh, thank God I refied in, you know, 2020 or 2021. And then like their next thought is, oh crap, you know, my fixed goes floating in 2025. or 26, or, you know, I go, you know, no am to full am in next year. And that's one of the mechanisms of the lagged effect of rising rates. So you just have to take it business by business. I mean, it's immediate for the residential real estate business and the refi and the refi mortgage business, and everything else is somewhere in between. So I don't have a call for the sector. It was immediate for SIVB and,
and
First Republic. So, you know, and the rest is like this slow bleed of deposit repricing. I'll say one thing about the banks in that regard. I think everybody thinks things are calming down because the deposit run is over. But, you know, why is the deposit run over? Because banks raised deposit rates and started replacing outflows with 5%+ CDs. So the run's over, but now there's incredible margin pressure. And they got protected by the fact that much of their loan portfolio is variable rate. So NIM hasn't been as bad as you would have thought, although it's bad. But now we're at the point where, I wonder how many of my variable rate borrowing customers are going to stay current at 8% when they took out the loan at 3%. And I wonder how many, you know, I'm going to be really conservative on credit. Like, how many good credits are there, you know, when you plug 8% into the cost of borrowing? So I think there's going to be a loan growth. It's almost like a stealth credit contraction coming, because I think borrowers and lenders alike are going to hesitate at 8% commercial borrowing rates. And that's why growth has stopped in the H8 data and all that. So it's not credit contraction because everyone's losing money on their loans, so they have to stop lending. It's different this time. It's like a different cousin of the cycle.
So related to that, Cy, the thing that's caught me by surprise, and I wonder if it isn't what's perpetuating the lag, the cycle, is the fact that lenders are still lending. I'm surprised to see that when I look at that H8 data, admittedly, it's slowed dramatically, but they are still expanding their loan books. And specifically, the commercial real estate segment has grown the fastest of all the categories. I mean, that blew my hair back when I saw that, because I would think that would be the first place, for the reasons you just so articulately outlined, they'd be cutting back. So is it just this confidence that, as you said earlier, credit's just normalizing and it's not going to get significantly worse? And maybe actually we've seen the worst of it already. And once the Fed stops raising rates, all these delinquencies will cure themselves and everything will be fine. Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. Again, it's uneven and some of it's lagged. I feel like it's slowing down. And I think the lag effect is, you know, look, there's been a construction boom, you know, multifamily and other parts of commercial real estate. It's a long pipeline, you know, things that were committed 2, 3, 4 years ago as construction finance, which banks tend not to do. The buildings are opening the last year or two, and now it's going from construction finance to mini perm or perm. It's that perm that's showing up as bank depository CRE. So maybe that's what you're saying. I don't think new loan growth is strong at all. Some areas are. Credit card somehow has been really strong. I mean, I know you and I are both shaking our heads right now.
Yeah. People are suicidal.
But it kind of makes sense. You know, it's the handoff from stimmy liquidity to, I got to keep my vengeance spending up, so I'll borrow credit cards. It seems crazy to me. You know, the card companies have had low losses, so they keep lending. But now they're lending to people who used to be just saving from stimmy, and now they're borrowing at 20% and rising. So how is that going to work out for you? You know, it's like, I don't think that's going to end well, you know, especially because of the compounding effect of the 20% interest rate. So, but, you know, so far in 2023, it's growing. So, like, you know, that part of it is, you know, I guess boosting the H8 data. I wouldn't characterize loan demand as strong, and I wouldn't characterize willingness to lend as strong in real time in November 2023.
I guess part of what plays into my sense about that is looking at the capital markets. where credit has actually become more available than I thought it would have been.
Private lending.
I mean, that just mushroomed out of nowhere to $1.5 trillion overnight all of a sudden.
Yeah, that's the new black box. That's the new Goldman and Lehman. You know, we didn't know what was on their balance sheet the last cycle, and we don't know what's on. And I don't have a lot of insight to that. I'm with you on the outside looking in at the black box and wondering.
What's in there? And every day I see a headline on Bloomberg about another bank that's trying to get into private credit because, you know, they're tired of having their market share stolen away by all these funds. So I don't know. But it's just another example of this desperate attempt, I think, to maintain those net interest margins in a world where it's increasingly difficult to do so because they are, like you said, paying up more to hold onto their deposits, and finding good quality credits to lend to is a lot harder to come by. But
I feel like you're trying to bait me into a really bearish, dark
this is what
credit.
I do. Come on over to the dark side side.
Okay, so I've got at least it's contrarian and cynical, but it's one of my like anti-fragile long plays, you know, that a cynic can be proud of. So we've spent a lot of time lately on auto, not lending, but auto insurance. So the auto insurance business is very cyclical. It's got its own little industry-specific cycle. And this past cycle has been, to some extent, like everything else, but different, has been bizarre. So the auto insurers actually made like a big mistake, you know, when COVID hit and said like, woo, you know, everyone's locked down, like no one driving their car, no accidents. It's awesome. You know, let's grow like crazy, you know, spend on brand advertising, buy clicks and leads, let's spend, grow, we'll cut prices to wave it in the door. And growth was great in 2020. And then while they were doing that, lockdown ends and everything goes wrong. Everything that could go wrong went wrong for this group of companies in 21 through basically earlier or now in 23. So, you know, we referred to it earlier, used car prices went up instead of down. Shortages of cars, demand, you know, goes up. Shortage of mechanics, you know, real supply chain problems with parts and labor and all that. People start driving again, have cash in their pocket, you know, want to own a second car, a third car, a fourth car, driving up the replacement value of cars. And insurance companies replace cars when they wreck. Of course, Mother Nature is cruel in, you know, 21 and 22 and early 23. And whether that's global warming or climate change or bad luck, we'll never know. It was really bad. So like catastrophe losses are bad on top of it. Low unemployment in like a ghoulish way is terrible for the car companies. Causes people to spend on driving vacations and tightens labor, makes the cost of repairs up. They drive more, they get into more accidents. Carjackings become a thing again for the first time in a while. It's bad. But insurance is like kind of a regulated and almost actuarial, you know, highly scientific business. They respond to the data. And, you know, when costs go through the roof, they respond by raising rates. And, you know, when they go to the regulators with the evidence and the regulators approve, you know, rate increases, basically bless, you know, rising insurance rates. And they're capitalists, so they reduce spend because their costs have gone up. They don't seek new customers. They just hunker down for the down cycle. And from here, I would say I'm going to just bet on the rising revenues that have started to hit from dramatically higher insurance rates. And I'll take the, you know, this time I will bet on reversion to the mean in Mother Nature and catastrophe losses. And since we, on this conversation, are less than sanguine on economic growth, you can say, you know, in the boardroom suites of the large insurance companies, they're like crossing their fingers, and they're kind of rooting for a rising unemployment and slowing economy and falling inflation. And this is where I think it's time to step in. It's turning. You know, the revenues are going up. It's November. It ended up being a weak hurricane season in 2023. Used car prices are starting to fall. Supply chains have been fixed. Labor is starting to loosen. You know, as ZipRecruiter said, the great resignation is over. And I think it's turning from a more horrible than usual down cycle, and that it's going to be a more excellent than usual up cycle on the way up. So the straightforward way to play it, and then I'll give you a less straightforward way to play it. The straightforward way to play it would be to own the insurance companies. And again, I got to own something that are financial. So I'm like thrilled to own the best auto insurer, Progressive. And I'm also happy to own less than best players that I kind of got battered in this down cycle. Allstate and Kemper would be publicly traded examples of that. So that's, you know, I think of them, this is like anti-fragile. In a world where the economy slows down, unemployment rate goes up, S&P 500 earnings miss, stocks go down, estimates for auto insurance underwriters would go up. You know, it would be the like the best performing by corporate profit sector in the S&P, or one of the best. So there's my anti-fragile, straightforward financial long. The other one, which is kind of second derivative of that, there are these companies called lead generators. You know, the first biggest and most successful of them last two cycles ago, you know, 20 years ago, was LendingTree. You know, they basically create sell leads and create marketplaces online for you to find financial products. They've really had a fall from grace, and I'm not involved in the stock, but just using it as an example that you would know. I mean, they're very heavy mortgage, so, you know, I just wouldn't want to touch them at the time. But there are, as ad spend and lead generation has become digitized and gone online and have moved away in the auto insurance business from agents and brokers in brick and mortar buildings in good locations where people drive up and go in and get auto insurance, is it this inexorable and powerful move towards shopping for auto insurance online or on the telephone. And the auto companies basically do that two ways. They buy ads every 5 minutes, seemingly on NFL football games and the Super Bowl and sporting events and, you know, anything on television. Ironically, they've all gone to like humorous ads, which, you know, I've always scratched my head about, like, oh, they're funny.
Right.
I'll get my insurance there. I'll have them insure my car. So they, you know, they do that. And they also, when they want to expand, they buy leads and clicks from these companies that come up when you type in, where can I get low cost auto insurance, the best deal on auto insurance. And it basically takes you to these, you know, marketplaces and, you know, lead generators. And those marketplaces and lead generators sell those leads and clicks and even take applications for the auto insurance companies for them. And they basically turn that off when they want to shrink, and they turn it on when they want to grow. But from cycle to cycle to cycle, it's absolutely a fantastic growth business. So of course, in 2020, when everything was awesome, a bunch of them went public as tech companies, you know, basic business lead generation, digital ad spend technology, and they were brought public, followed by tech analysts and traded really high multiples of cash flow and all that. And then they busted. Nobody knew that they needed to track the insurance pricing cycles. So they all busted as stocks and have been kind of orphaned in a way since then. But it's sort of like, you know, what is it called? Like the tail end of the whip. When the cycle turns and the auto companies want to spend to gain market share, to make up volume, to make up for their underwriting losses of last cycle, and because revenue and cash flow so strong from all these prodigious price increases, the marginal spending dollars going, you know, there's only so many Super Bowl ads you can buy. You know, you also want to buy clicks and leads. So I think that's happening right now. Like we heard like the first little whispers of it on third quarter earnings of Progressive and Allstate and Kemper. And I think they're starting to come out of their shell and spend a little more money. It tends to be an annual advertising budget thing. So I think this is going to take off in January in the first quarter. And however bad the last 3 years are going to be, the next 3 years are going to be more fantastic, you know, with higher highs than the last cycle. And these companies, again, I'm kind of staying away from LendingTree, sort of the former leader of the business. The best of the rest is a company called QuinStreet, which we own. And there are a couple other smaller cap ones. I think they're going to turn, you know, estimates are going to go up. They're sort of like a levered way to play the actual underwriting cycle with a little bit of a, they'll be seen as tech plays again when the growth rates are phenomenal. They'll talk the digitization up and all that. And I just think these are 3-4 baggers in the next couple few years. I'm sure I'll sell them too early because they'll seem expensive. And in our next podcast in 3 years, I'll be complaining about having shorted them too early. But I think they're got like a great multi-year run, and they're more or less like still on their ass. So I think the timing's really right there.
Interesting. So can we backpedal a little bit to the broader macro landscape and just get your sense as to where the Fed is? Do you think they're done? Do you think they're going to raise more? Or do you...
Again, I'm not, you know, I don't have positions to reflect this, really. My gut is that they're done. And that's my gut because I'm like a recessionista. Like, I think we're heading towards a recession. So I assume inflation's going to cool, you know, whether it gets to their 2 or 3% target. I already slipped there. It's a 2% target. They get to 2 or 3 and they raise their target. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, what I'm more fascinated by, I actually wanted to ask you. And
I was
going to
say the Bank of Japan thing. Is that what you're
asking? Yeah. I'm so fascinated by, you know, Grant's recent podcast with Jim Aitken about the three words in the English language that don't belong together, Japanese hiking cycle. And I mean, it's like a crazy situation that our rates are above the rate of inflation. We're trying to bring inflation down to a target with our high rates. They've been trying to get their inflation up with zero rates. So they're where we were 3, 4, 5 years ago. And, you know, these huge superpowers in the world economy, they're trying to nudge inflation in opposite directions. And it looked part of the answer of what the Fed ends up doing, what happens to US rates, is what happens in Japan. And if Aitken is right and they declare victory and say, woohoo, you know, we got inflation up to 2%, time to normalize QE and let Japanese savers, or this is Watanabe, whatever they call them, you know, earn a positive return on their savings. Or I guess that would upset Mrs. Watanabe if she's doing the carry trade, speculating on other currencies. But if they normalize interest rates so that there's positive absolute rates and, God forbid, real rates again, you know, like, I have more questions than answers. You know, what does that do to the dollar? What does that do to the U.S. to U.S. interest rates? I would think it hurts the dollar and it's great for gold. So that's one of the reasons I care. But it's fascinating. You know, it's, you know, James's case for volunteering for the Widowmaker trade, you know, betting on higher Japanese yen was really powerful. Like, but it's the Widowmaker. It's always the Widowmaker. So
I mean, as long as you and I have been in business, there was that, you know, short JGBs, and every year the hedge funds would come out and they'd short JGBs and they'd lose money. And finally, we reached a point where they just finally gave up. And maybe now is the time to reposition that. But yeah, I mean, I guess the question I have about it, like you, I have many more questions than answers. Number one is, like, how are they going to orchestrate this? Because so far they seem to be trying to step away from the yield curve control, and it's not having the desired effect. And, you know, yields have backed up a little, but the yen has not appreciated at all, which I think has been a little confounding. But
I guess currency manipulation, you know, doesn't always work. So I think Aitken's case is they're going to have to go to the next level, which is actually letting rates rise, and that the way it would come about, I'm just paraphrasing, you know, like your previous guest, would be to declare victory and say, okay, mission accomplished. We can let rates normalize because we've achieved our inflation target. And that's how that would replace buying JGBs, of which there's like none left to buy. That would replace buying JGBs as the way to defend the yen. Because again, I assume, I'm not like an FX guy, I assume the yen would rally like mad if they let, you know, they went from negative rates to positive rates and let, you know, long-term JGBs go from, you know, 75 bips to, you know, 2% or something like that. They would win the battle to strengthen the yen.
Sounds a little too cowboy for me. For the Bank of Japan to just say, all right, we're going to let go. We're going to let the free markets decide. I don't know, after all of this, to just go that dramatically on the other end. But I mean, it would shock the markets. And I think you're right. I mean, it would definitely get the yen going up in a hurry. What happens after that is a question. I'm very curious as to what extent, if any, there's still some remnants of the yen carry trade undergirding the credit risk here in the U.S. And I guess
that's the fear.
That.
Yeah, you don't know. You know, like the yen rising. You know, I say, ooh, you know, gold would finally break out.
Right.
But you know, lots of assets are owned by the carry trade, and you know, it's derivatives world and prop desks all around the world. And you know, I don't know from that stuff and know how to figure out what everybody else is doing. You know,
so
as I said earlier,
add that to the list of things that could possibly happen in 2024 in this world that we've got. So we've got the election, we've got wars, Ukraine and Israel, we've got possibly BOJ ending.
Add it to the list of my physical.
You have anything else you want to throw on there, Si, while we're at it?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I think we've gone 3 years worth here.
Let's hope. Well, thank you for joining us again in a moment of weakness. I really appreciate you doing it. And we would definitely will have to revisit and see how all this plays out, you know, over the next several months, if you're game for it.
Yeah, awesome. I look forward to it.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Well, Steph, I have to say, first of all, kudos to you for getting Si to come and talk to us again. And secondly, how much fun was that?
Amazing. He always brings this A-game. And I thought it was a really great insight into how a really good long and short seller positions. He's not dogmatic about specific themes. Like, he identifies opportunities and he's flexible, which is so key.
Well, particularly given how damn difficult it is right now. Jeez, I mean, Louise, I would hate to be trying to be a short seller right now. I mean, it's just so tough. And you know, some of those examples he gave, you know, that's where a lot of people get tripped up, right? They all want to catch the 400 to zero, when at the end of the day, catching the 100 to zero, if you've got more confidence, you can size the position bigger, you're going to end up making as much money, right, with less risk. And that's really difficult for a lot of people to do.
And it was difficult before, but this whole introduction of this swath of retail investors that clearly doesn't understand how basic analysis works and to whom it's utterly irrelevant. I mean, I still remember, and it probably wasn't long after we recorded the first conversation, that Hertz filed for bankruptcy. And when the stock basically went to zero, everyone piled in and it, yeah, like, this is not how it's supposed to work, people. So yeah, short selling into that.
I think a lot of the people that did that have been subsequently chased out of the market, which is, you know, it's a shame, right? It's a shame that people have had to lose a lot of money to find out how it all works. And I hope they all got out at the top. I really do. But I somehow suspect that the people selling at the top were selling to them rather than buying from them, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, that's sadly how it usually works.
Yeah. Well, never mind. Anyway, as always, we should thank our guest, Si Jacobs of Jam Partners, for coming on and spending that hour and change with us, which was as much fun this time as it was last time. And my thanks to you, Stephanie Pomboy, for giving up your time, because it's always a pleasure to see you and get a chance to chat with you. So thank you.
I mean, this is the only time I get to see you. I have to come up with these guests for a podcast so that I can actually get to talk to you.
Listen, if anybody out there believes that for 1 second, I don't think you're fooling anybody. I will sit and chat with you all day, every day if I get the chance.
Oh my gosh.
Well, listen, for anybody out there listening that doesn't know how to follow Steph on Twitter, I'm going to save her the trouble and tell you it's at S Pomboy. Accept no imitations. There are plenty of them out there with ones and zeros and all kinds of stuff going on. And if you don't follow me, that's easy to do as well. You'll find me at TTMYGH. So I guess that's it for now, Steph. We will do this again soon, I hope, and I will badger you until you agree to do it.
No, vice versa.
All right, I'll see you soon. Take care.
See ya. Bye.
Nothing we discussed during the Super Terrific Happy Hour should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, to say nothing of super and terrific, of course, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.